1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 15 through 30 tonight, so we're going to finish out the chapter. For some reason, we picked up some bad habits here at Anchored Fellowship lately, that even on Wednesday nights, we aren't getting through entire chapters like we're supposed to. Did you notice how I included you in that, even though you had nothing to do with it? I don't know why, it just makes me feel better if I can take someone down with me, but we're going to try to break that cycle tonight. We're going to finish out this chapter. It should be easy for us to do. It's a half a chapter. And then next week we should be able to get back to a little bit quicker pace on Wednesday nights. That's fine for Sunday morning, you know. Whatever happens on Sunday morning, we trust the Lord with that. If he wants to really have us dig in and do just a few verses, I like that. That's fine. But Wednesday nights, we really do need to get moving or we will never teach through the Old Testament. The Lord will come back. And I can't say for sure that he'll let me finish this in the millennial kingdom. He might. I don't know. But yeah, we're gonna have to pick up our pace there, and we will. A lot has happened in the first 14 verses of chapter 18. In a nutshell, God has promised that David is going to rise to the position of king, and God is in the beginning stages of coming through on that promise. David is just going to keep rising. He's just going to keep being lifted up and placed ultimately in the position that the Lord would have him to be. And that's a great truth for all Christians. You know, nothing can hold you down when the Lord decides to lift you up. And the way we do that, of course, is through humbling ourselves, right? When we humble ourselves, the Lord exalts us. If we exalt ourselves, then the Lord humbles us. And that's a good picture here between Saul and David. You got the guy that's exalting himself. It's all about self. It's all about ego. It's all about pride. And the Lord is going to bring him down. And then you have the humble guy, David, and the Lord has chosen him, and he stays humble, and the Lord is going to, in due time, exalt him and lift him up. While Saul's in the process of dealing with those frustrations right now, the Lord just keeps lifting David up, and Saul's trying to hold him down. That's the meaning of my title. You know, you can't keep a God's man down. This is Saul trying to hold David down from being elevated to where the Lord wants him. And those efforts are going to be in vain, of course, but we come here in the first 14 verses and we see Saul's own son, Jonathan. He can't help but to love the guy, David, and they become just the closest of buddies. They make a friendship covenant, we take it, a friendship covenant together with one another. And then Saul keeps sending David off to war, and David continues his heroics, building off of his heroics from taking down Goliath. And he becomes well known to the nation. He becomes sort of the national hero, and that's totally fine with Saul. He has no problem with that until on one of those occasions when they come home from war. And the ladies have decided to write a little ditty. They've decided to write a little song about this situation, and that song would be, you know, our King Saul, he's so-so, but David's awesome. Now, I know I paraphrased that for meaning, but believe me, that's how Saul heard it. You know, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. That's how Saul heard that. He heard that as, well, our king's okay-ish, but David, he's just awesome. He's the best. And Saul is now afraid. He is afraid of David's rise. You're going to read that, I think, at least three times, maybe four times in this chapter, that as we go, Saul just keeps developing more and more fear, because the harder he tries, the more apparent it becomes that God's Spirit is on David's life and has departed from his life. He's just very well aware of that at this point. And what do you do if you're Saul? You know, at this point, Saul being Saul, well, he's going to have to try to find a way to off David. That's really his only option, at least. That's the way that it seems to him. Got to find a way to get this guy David killed, because I'm not going to beat him in any other way. And he tried that first himself, didn't he? In a demonic fit of rage, he tried to spear David through and pin him to the wall multiple times. And multiple times David escaped. And then that brings us current. And for the rest of the chapter, it's a little bit strange, but Saul kind of dials it back a little bit. You wouldn't expect that from Saul, but he dials it back a little bit. He's no longer going to actively himself go after David. Instead, he's going to try to use his enemies to take out his enemy, David. He's going to try to set David up to get himself killed. You'll see how all of that works and how all of this progresses. And it's just funny to kind of watch Saul changing up his plans. And this goes on into the next chapter as well. It just keeps going. He'll try to do something to get David dead. And when David doesn't get dead, then he's like, okay, well, next plan. I got to come up with something. You ever watch Pinky and the Brain? It's kind of like that. You know, every day trying to figure out, how can I take over the world today? And everything fails. Well, let's begin reading and see if Saul has any luck at taking down David. Verse 15. And when Saul saw that he, David, had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. Now, remember from last week how this went. Saul initially put David in command of soldiers because Saul liked David at the time. He didn't have a problem with David. And he was capitalizing off of David's success. You know, David had taken down Goliath. This was a poster child for the army, right? You're like, you're going to recruit, you get this guy as your poster child. And Saul was capitalizing on that. And David continued having success. He was just completely unbeatable. If he was leading soldiers, just without a doubt, they were going to win. And again, all of that was fine with Saul until the ladies sang that insulting little ditty. And now Saul doesn't want David to win anymore. He started out genuinely wanting David to win. Like, that was a good situation. It's no longer a good situation. He doesn't want David to win, but the problem is David keeps winning. So in verse 13, I suggested that Saul had promoted David to lead more men. We're told there that he leads 1,000 men at that point. And the reason that he did that was to try to get David killed. Now, I should mention that it's also possible that that was not a promotion, but that it was actually a demotion, which would mean that in verse 5, David was actually appointed over more men, more than 1,000, maybe perhaps a whole army. And then in verse 13, he is demoted and lessened to command over only 1,000. That is absolutely possible. It is very difficult to tell exactly what's happening there. But either way, promotion or demotion, the point is, this is kind of like what I was telling you. It's Saul making moves, changing up his strategy to try to get David killed on the battlefield. And he'll do anything that he can, anything that it takes in order to make that happen. So it's basically like, okay, he's leading less men right now, and that's not working, he's winning. Maybe if he leads less men, maybe if I demote him, maybe that puts him out in the battle more. He's just more engulfed in battle. Maybe he's more likely to get killed in that situation. Or, you know, if it's the other way around, then it would be, okay, he's leading less men now, and he's surviving, and he's continuing to be a hero, so maybe if I put him in charge of more soldiers, or less soldiers, I got myself confused, but either way, right? More soldiers, less soldiers, promotion, demotion. The point is, he's doing whatever he can to move the pieces and try to get David killed. And whatever exactly it is that he's going for right now, nothing is working. Whatever Saul throws at David, David knocks it out of the park because, again, the Lord is with David. And that's the continued theme here. Verse 16. But all Israel and Judah, and just stop right there for a moment because I find that statement interesting. All Israel and Judah, that is actually the first time in the Old Testament scriptures that Israel and Judah are handled separately like that, as if they are two completely different nations. Usually all of the tribes are just lumped in there under the title of Israel, and that's not what we see here. For the first time we have this split up. I would point out that this was well before the nation of Israel actually did divide up into the 10 northern tribes of Israel and the 2 southern tribes of Judah. This is well before that. But I would also like to point out that when these two books were written, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, the author had already known about the dividing up of the kingdom. So these were written after the kingdom was already divided up. So it was probably inserted for us, inspired by the Lord, of course, and inserted for us as sort of a foreshadowing of what's to come. Not just that there is going to be a dividing up of the nation here, but that there's actually already a move happening within the nation where this one identity, Israel, is slowly becoming two separate identities, Israel and Judah. Those differentiations are beginning to form and evidence themselves. And you ask the question, do I have any proof for that? Well, yeah, I think I do. Actually, if you turn back to chapter 11, when they are numbering the army, quote unquote, the army of Israel, the counts for Israel and Judah are actually handled separately. We are first given Israel's soldier tally, and then separately we are given Judah's soldier tally. So it's almost like they're being treated there as two separate armies. And that could explain why David will refer to the army of Israel as the armies of the living God. That could be why he says that. Now, I do believe that also is David factoring in the heavenly host, the angelic army that fights for them. I really do truly believe that, and I've given you my case for that, my rationale for that, and I'll leave it at that. But yeah, it's just interesting here already to see sort of the crossroads where these two sections of the nation begin to go their separate ways. Reading on in verse 16 then, but all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. He went out and he came in. That's a Hebrew expression. And usually it just means leaving and returning to your home or to your people, to your family, to your city, as the case may be. It's also used to refer to heading out into battle and returning from battle. And I think the context would tip us in that favor to see this as a reference to David's military victories. He's heading out for battle and he's coming back successfully. And the whole nation's just loving this guy. Wherever you send David, you've got a victory. This is amazing. You know, Israel's stock is up. Things are going well. And that's good for everyone except one guy. And that would be Saul. This is all just making Saul more and more jealous. Verse 17. Then Saul said to David, here is my eldest daughter, Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. And you know what we just found out there at verse 17? We just found out that Saul has yet to come through on the promise that he made to Goliath's conqueror. Do you remember the incentive package that he offered to all of the soldiers in the nation? He said, any soldier that's willing to fight and is able to defeat the giant Goliath, here's the incentive package. You're going to be extremely wealthy. I'm going to make sure you are. I'm going to give you a lump sum of cash for defeating Goliath. And you're going to be tax exempt in the nation of Israel, number two. And then number three was what? You're going to marry my daughter. You're going to marry the king's daughter. And as we study this chapter, it sure does sound like David never got any of that. He never got the wealth. How do I know that? Well, because he is going to be incapable of paying a dowry here in just a little bit. So he doesn't have the wealth. I don't know about his tax-free status. Maybe he did get that tax-exempt status. I don't know. For sure, number three, we know that David has yet to marry a daughter of Saul. So this is Saul breaking his word, and it's even worse than breaking his word, because now what he's actually doing is he's promising the same thing or one of the same things, only he's asking for David to continue to earn or to re-earn what David has technically already earned by defeating Goliath. You defeat Goliath, you get my wife. Or pardon me, you get my daughter as your wife. That's a terrible statement. Rewind. Edit that, please. Yeah, you defeat Goliath, you get my daughter as your wife. Well, now he's saying, all right, if you want to marry my daughter, you can do that, but I'm going to need you to keep fighting for a while. I need you to just keep soldiering on for a little while. And if you'll do that, then eventually I'll give my daughter to be your wife. And of course, he's not really going to do that. He's not going to give Merab to David. He has no intentions of that. All he's doing is he's trying to keep David as a soldier. He's trying to keep him fighting. This is a little bit of motivation. He's going to sweeten that motivation and sweeten the deal in just a little while here. But Saul right here reminds me so much of a guy named Laban. Do you remember that weasel Laban from the book of Genesis? And it was that guy, Jacob's uncle, that conned him out of Rachel. He had agreed to work 7 years for Rachel's hand in marriage. That was the dowry. And he did. He put in his 7 hard years and he thought he married her. And, you know, they consummated the marriage that night and he woke up. And I love the King James Version. It says, behold, it was Leah. Whoa. That's not who I worked 7 years to marry. No, the oldest was given to Jacob first. So Laban conned him and then he was able to get another 7 years of labor out of Jacob so that Jacob could finally get Rachel, the wife that he loved and really wanted in the first place. This is what Saul's doing here. He's using his daughters as a way to get stuff from David, but more importantly, he's using his daughters as a way to serve as a snare for David, to get him in a situation where he ends up laying dead on a battlefield. Reading on in verse 17, here's his rationale. We don't have to guess about this. We find out his intentions right here. For Saul thought, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So this is really just Saul stalling. He's buying time. And he's going to keep throwing David in impossible military situations against odds, against the Philistines, in hopes that on one of those occasions, David ends up killed. So I just love this part of the story because you have Saul here only thinking about himself. And what he's trying to do is now use his enemies to kill his enemy. He's trying to use his Philistine enemies to do the dirty work and kill his quote-unquote enemy, David. But you have God on the other side of things, and God is thinking about the nation of Israel. God sees all of this. He knows about all of Saul's plans, and he takes all of it, and he's thinking about Israel. And what he does is he uses all of these plots and plans to defeat the enemies of Israel, the actual enemies of Israel, the Philistines. So I just love that. It's like the classic case in point for the story of Joseph being sold into slavery later on, saying to his brothers, yeah, you guys did me dirty, but what you meant for evil, God meant for good. Like God really was working behind all of that. You were plotting and you were scheming. You thought you were doing me wrong, but actually the Lord was taking all of that and turning it around and using it for good. So that's exactly what the Lord is doing here. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the countryside there to, you know, hear those conversations. You know, Saul saying to David, all right, David, take 3,000 men. I want you to go out. You're going to go against 30,000 Philistines and, you know, come back when you're victorious. And, you know, moments later, there's David back saying, okay, done. We won and didn't lose a soldier. And every time that happens, Saul is just scratching his head and completely frustrated. Like, how can I put this guy in a situation that's so overwhelming that even the Lord isn't able to deliver him from it and bail him out of it? It had to be extremely frustrating for Saul. Of course, I realize we're not really all that sympathetic to Saul at this point, but imagine how frustrating that was for Saul. So plot number one on the life of David was Saul with a spear. Plot number two was Saul throwing David into constant battles in hopes that he'd get him killed. Plot number three was giving David some additional motivation to stay in those battles and maybe perhaps set David up so that he could put him in more risky situations, and that David, out of desire for a wife, might be a little bit reckless in those moments. So that was like Saul dangling the carrot. I hate to say that, ladies, but you know, Merab here, she was the carrot that was dangling before Saul, before David, pardon me. She's the bait for the trap. And it's not going to be the last time that he does something like this. He's going to do this in just a few moments with his other daughter. And he's just not a real great guy, if you haven't noticed. Just not a very high character type of individual. Verse 18. And David said to Saul, "Who am I and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" So David was just too humble here to accept his offer of his daughter's hand in marriage. I think David knew his station in life. And he definitely knew Merib's station in life. She was a princess. She was the daughter of a king. He was a shepherd turned soldier. But shepherd turning soldier marrying a princess, that wasn't really something that happened too often back then. Station in life really mattered in those early cultures throughout history. Truth is, it wasn't really until the 20th century where love became really the only factor in consideration when it comes to marriage. That was the 20th century. You realize that, right? So I know this makes like for a really good plot for a Jane Austen novel. It was truly something that just did not happen very commonly, and maybe we don't realize how big of a deal it is because for us, love's all that matters. And it doesn't matter what a person's wealth status is or poverty status, doesn't matter if they're someone important in life or not. If they love each other, yeah, we approve. That's us. But that was not them. This was something that just really didn't happen until the 20th century. So verse 19, "But at that time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David," so there was a timeline set for this, and that timeline has come, and she should have been given to David, but she was given to Adriel the Maholathite for a wife. So Saul's just in over his head here. He's trying his best to get David killed. He's setting deadlines for all of this stuff, or battles where it's supposed to happen, that kind of thing. All of that's just coming and going. David's still kicking. And he gets to the point where he has to keep backing off of his word. He has to keep breaking his word. By the way, here's a feather in your Bible knowledge cap if you want it. Adriel and Merab, they get married here. They end up having 5 sons. And in 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 8 and 9, those 5 sons will be taken by the Gibeonites and hung. So this couple here, Adriel and Merab, this is not exactly a happily ever after story. The question mark would be, does her husband get taken and killed by the Gibeonites as well? We're not real sure. She could be a widow and sonless for sure. She's sonless by 2 Samuel chapter 21. Verse 20. Now Saul's daughter, this is his other daughter, because the one he promised to David first, Merab, she was given to another man. So Saul's other daughter, Michal, loved David. Of course she loved David. Everyone loved David. It was almost enough to make a man jealous. Of course she loved David. And it says, they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Now, before you lose your mind and lose your wits and think that Saul has turned a good leaf here, just wait for the punchline. Wait for the rest of it here. Why does this thing please Saul? Why does it please Saul that his daughter Michal loves David? Here's why. Verse 21. Saul thought, let me give her to him that she may be a snare for him. Okay, first of all, daughters, if your father gives your hand in marriage to his enemy as an act of revenge, it is time to examine yourself and change your ways. Now that statement is true, okay, but that's not the full story of what's happening here. Michal really isn't the problem. He's not like dumping his problem kid off to David and thinking, well, that's going to ruin his life. I like to joke about that, but that's not really what's happening here, all right? This problem, it's all Saul's. Michal, she's just an innocent pawn in this. Reading on in verse 21. And that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So he's going to use her in order to get the Philistines against David. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." That first time, yeah, sorry about that, just kidding. Okay, now I'm serious. Now I'm ready for you to marry one of my daughters. I'm going to give you Michal. All right, first of all, the name Michal, that is the feminine version of Michael, and it really should not be pronounced Michael. I've heard people do that. They'll take this name here in 1 Samuel 21, and they'll pronounce it Michael. I've probably even done that before, but it actually is pronounced Michal. Now, if you don't want to do the Hebrew guttural, then you would pronounce it Michal. It is the feminine version of Michael, which would be English equivalent Michelle. So if you don't want to do the Michal, the guttural, then you can do Michal. If you'd rather, you can do the English equivalent Michelle. And what's happening here is that David and Michal are really, truly, deeply, madly in love. For sure we know that as far as Michal is concerned. We read in verse 20 that Michal loved David. That's actually a powerful, powerful statement. It is the only time in the scriptures, the only time where we have a statement in the third person like this to tell us that one particular individual, one particular woman loved a particular man, and we're given names. It's the only time something like this appears. Now, of course, love is insinuated multiple times, many times in the scriptures. You know, Song of Solomon, the Shulamite woman, right? So, yeah, there are insinuations of love, but never are we told like this, person A loves person B. And as far as David is concerned, were those reciprocated feelings? Yes, I think they were. Because in just a few moments, Saul is going to request that David do something absolutely ridiculous and quite a bit gross in order to win her hand in marriage, and he's going to do it, and like he wastes no time. So actions speak louder than words. Yes, I think David returned those emotions. I think he loved her too. I think that was what was told to Saul. I think they let Saul know, look, these two are actually really in love. Michal really loves David. And Paul sees this as an opportunity to leverage in order to get David killed. So it's another reason. It just kind of lends itself to the fact that he knew David had feelings for Michal too. And he could use those. He could use those feelings. He could use that love as a trap, as a snare, to get David to stumble and be killed. So, as you can see, it's not really Saul giving away his horrible, terrible daughter as an act of revenge to get this guy back. No, it's him using those emotions, those desires to be together. It's him using the love that exists between these two in order to trip him up, you know, to steer him into harm's way and get him killed. And to play Saul's advocate, this is actually Saul's best plan yet. I'll show you why that is in just a moment. It would seem like, barring divine intervention, it would seem like a pretty surefire way to get David killed. Verse 22. And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you.'" Now, in verse 21, Saul told David to marry his daughter. We are not told about a response from David there. We're going to be given a response from David shortly. But we know that he was hesitant. And he's going to express that, you know, real soon here in the text. David is hesitant to marry even Michal, even though I believe he really loves her. He's hesitant to do that. So Saul here has to send servants to David to try to butter him up and to try to let him know, look, I know it feels like Saul hates you. Probably the whole, you know, trying to throw a spear through your guts thing a couple times. But listen, when Saul's not in one of his demonic tirades, he's actually a pretty good guy. He'd be a pretty good father-in-law. You know what? He really likes you, David. He really does. So I think you should marry the king's daughter. So they're trying to butter him up, make him feel better about the situation. And he goes on to say, all his servants love you. You know, it's not just the king, it's the whole palace. It's everyone working for Saul. You know, this is a good situation for you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law. Verse 23. And Saul's servants spoke those words in the ears of David, and David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing?" In other words, this is a big, big deal. This is a decision that I cannot make lightly. It's a big deal, reading on, to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation. So again, this is about station in life. He's poor. He's of no reputation. She's royalty. He's not. And he does not have the money to pay for a dowry, let alone to pay for a dowry for a princess. Are you kidding me? Verse 24. And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." Thus and so did David speak. I really expected the ESV to modernize that language a little bit more, but I don't hate it. I actually kind of like it. It reminds me of my KJV days. You know, "Thus and so did David speak." Verse 25. Then Saul said, "Thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price, no dowry, except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged on the king's enemies." Okay, so there actually is a dowry then. He said, "I don't need a dowry," but what did he ask for? He did ask for a dowry. It's just a really weird one. So first, let's talk real quick about dowries. We've covered this before, but just to be thorough, when a father gave you permission to marry his daughter, that did not mean you could do so free. Even if he told you, you know, "You can have my daughter as your wife," what that meant was, "You're going to have to come up with a dowry to pay me." That was not a free exchange. Now, before you ladies, like, get really confused about this, you should not think of this as a man purchasing a woman for money as if she's a possession. That is not at all what this was. There are two different ways to look at it. Number one, you could look at it as alimony up front, just in case he was a jerk and he ran off and left the woman and she was without a husband, all right? So alimony up front, or number two, insurance up front, in case the man ends up dying and leaving her as a widow. Because at the time, women really weren't the breadwinners in the families. They didn't make the money. It was the men that went out that labored. It was the men that brought the money in. So a woman on her own, she was in a vulnerable position. That was, remember, the very background for the story of Ruth, the book of Ruth and Naomi and, you know, that whole thing. So big deal. A woman needs to have some kind of financial guarantee that if her husband either dies or leaves her, that the mom and dad then can take that dowry. Hopefully they didn't blow it on Amazon stuff. And then they can give that dowry to the woman and she can continue to finance her lifestyle. So that was supposed to happen regardless. And reading on, it says, before the time had expired. So again, Saul has another deadline here. We don't know what it is. We aren't told, but there is a deadline here. Saul basically said, you know, you'll do this thing. You'll go get these 100 Philistine foreskins. You'll do that by a certain time. And then once you give those to me by that certain deadline, then she is yours as a wife. Reading in verse 27, David arose and went along with his men. So he did not waste a moment here. If I don't know how long this deadline was, but if it was more than a couple days, it was excessive, because David gets right to it. He's going to be back in a jiffy with Philistine foreskins. David arose and went along with his men. So he does have his 1,000 soldiers with him here, but they are on their own. All right. That's what's different about this plan. All of Saul's past plans that involved getting David killed out in battle, that was David out with the whole army. David's not out with the whole army now. Saul has sent him out with just his 1,000 men. All right, so hold that thought for a moment. And it says that David and his men killed 200 of the Philistines. How many did Saul ask for? He asked for 100 Philistine foreskins. And then here's David walking back into town with 200 Philistine foreskin. So he's given twice the asking price. I can assure you, Saul did not expect to see this sight. David walking back into town with 200 Philistine foreskins slung over his back. No, not at all. He thought for sure that this would be what takes David down. And here's why. Good luck taking 1,000 men and going out and finding 100 Philistines on their own in the same area, waiting to be overcome, and go ahead and try that and see what happens. First of all, you're not going to find 100 or 200 or 300 Philistines around by themselves. You're probably going to find a more formidable force of Philistines. If you do find a smaller number of Philistines, then here's what's going to happen. When you attack them with your 1,000 men, you're poking the bear. And the Philistines are going to get reinforcement. And before long, you're going to be staring down 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 or 20,000. And what do you got? You don't got the whole army this time. You got just your 1,000 men. You see how this is a trap? This is most certainly a trap. But David was successful. He comes back with twice the asking price. It says, and David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king. So 200 of them, twice the asking price. Remember this, Jesus once said, if someone asks you to go 1 mile with him, go with him 2 miles. So this is the Old Testament version of that. If someone asks 100 foreskins from you, give them 200 Philistine foreskins. That's how it's supposed to work. Write that down. You might need that sometime. It's the Old Testament principle that Jesus gave us there. And way more gross. Reading on. They were given in full number to the king, which is kind of funny. The statement's funny because it means someone like had to count them. You know, one of the servants. Okay, there's one, there's two. Anyway, I shouldn't think about these things, but I do. The full number were given to the king that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, for a wife. Because what else could he do at that point? He can't win. No matter what odds Saul throws at David, David wins. You just, as the title says, you can't keep a God's man down, or a God's woman for that matter. This battle for us is already won. We are more than conquerors. If God be for us, who can be against us? All of those passages that promise us, we've already got the victory. So the battle is just, it's futile. It's exercise, right? So remember that when you're dealing with your enemies. You may be frustrated that they keep coming after you. You may be frustrated that, you know, they plot for you and you avoid it. The Lord helps you, but they keep coming and they keep coming and they keep attacking. And the attacks keep getting more creative and more destructive. You may be frustrated that that's happening, but I would say to you, don't pity yourself in that situation. Think about this story. Who should be pitied here? Think about this story. It's your enemies that deserve the pity. You should pity them. For how frustrating it must be to keep coming after you when God has determined to bless you, when God has determined to protect you. See, you're only looking at it from your side. They keep attacking me. This is frustrating. Yes, think of how frustrating it is for them to lay the traps for you and then to trip and fall into them themselves, as the scripture says. To come after you, to blast you, only to find out that the Lord has blessed you. To try to get a step ahead of you, only to find out that the Lord has you a couple steps ahead of them. So, thank God that when He determines to set us at a certain height, whether that be in, you know, vocation, earthly vocation, or spiritual life, when He decides to set us at a certain height, He will keep rising us until He gets us there, and nothing's going to stop that. Nothing can stop the Lord when He determines to bless your life. Before we move on, quick question. I wonder what Michal thought of this dowry. Instead of money, 100 foreskins, it ends up being 200 Philistine foreskins. I wonder what she thought of that. Because remember, this is her future. If David either takes off or ends up croaking, this is all that she would have to her name, 200 Philistine foreskins. I wonder if she was upset with her father over that. Because you can't trade those at the market. No one wants those. I mean, you can't even make it into like wallets and purses. No one wants that stuff either. Again, I don't know why I think of this stuff, but I do. So, verse 28. Aren't you glad it's almost over? We're almost done here. Verse 28. If you don't know what foreskins are, well, I would tell you to go look it up later, but no, don't do that. You're going to come up with the wrong search results. Yeah, definitely just talk to me after service, and I'll tell you what that is. Verse 28, but when Saul saw, thank goodness that's the last time I have to read that, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, verse 29, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. So basically nothing changes from this point. Verse 30, then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle. And as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. He just keeps, you know, being the hero for the nation. And I love this. His name was highly esteemed. Literally, in the Hebrew, David's name means beloved. And that's what we were just told. His name becomes beloved in Israel. Well, that's what his name means. His name means beloved. So he's living up to his name here. Now, next week, Saul is going to come out in the open with his desire to kill David. This is how it's going to progress, right? We started in the chapter where Saul tried to kill David himself. That did not work. I'm surprised he abandoned that so quickly. But eventually he is private and quiet and sneaky kind of way. He then moves to trying to get David killed in battle. He's tried to sweeten that deal a couple times. He's tried to put David in some crazy situations. None of that's working, so now Saul moves on to his next phase, which is, okay, I need help. I have to get this guy killed. And I can't seem to figure out how to do it, either myself or through battle. So I'm going to have to get all of my staff on board with this. I'm going to have to tell them. So he's going to tell his son Jonathan. That's not going to work out, right? Jonathan loves David. He's got a covenant with David. He's going to tell his son Jonathan, yeah, I want David dead. We're going to try to figure out how to do that. He's going to tell all of his servants that he wants David dead. And we'll find out next week how that unfolds. All right, let's stand. We're going to close in a word of prayer.